Welcome to Israel War Briefing, a podcast from the Jewish Chronicle, the oldest Jewish newspaper in the world. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons, editor of the Jewish Chronicle and author of Israelophobia, the newest version of the oldest hatred and what to do about it. In each episode, I have a one-to-one conversation with someone worth listening to. This week, my guest is the influential German-American political scientist Yasha Monk, author of The Identity Trap. The conversation took place at Book Week 24.
This is the Jewish Literary Foundation's Book Week Festival, formerly Jewish Book Week. And this evening's event is with Yasha Monk, author of The Identity Trap, which is here. And if you haven't got it, get it. My name is Jake Wallace-Simons. I'm the editor of the Jewish Chronicle and the author of Israelophobia. And I'm delighted to be in conversation with Yasha about his book. Just a few words of introduction about Yasha. Yasha is a writer and academic known for his work on the rise of populism and the crisis of liberal democracy. Born in Germany to Polish parents, Monk received his BA in history from Trinity College, the University of Cambridge, and his PhD in government from Harvard. He's now a professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, the founder of the online magazine Persuasion, not to be confused by the novel of the same name, and a publisher of Die Zeit. He's the author of The People vs. Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It, and The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. So I'm not sure how one claps in this environment, but whatever you're going to do, do it now. And welcome Yasha.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Really looking forward to this conversation, Jake.
So your book, I really, really enjoyed it. Really stimulating. And as I mentioned in our offline chat, it was fascinating to speak to somebody who's coming from the left, from an academic intellectual background, critiquing the new radicalism, as I've tended to call it, that's gripping the left. But first of all, as a sort of ramp into our discussion, could you just run us through two key ideas in your book? One is the identity synthesis, and the other, which is what the book takes its name from, is the identity trap.
Yeah, so first of all, I think that, you know, we have witnessed in the last decades the birth of a genuinely new ideology, a new set of ideas about race and gender and sexual orientation that started in the academy, spread out a little bit to activists, remained quite marginal to the mainstream, but then suddenly took a lot of speed and a lot of power. And it's really transformed how large parts of the left, and even many mainstream institutions, think of their values, their norms, their ideals, their guiding practices. And this is indeed rooted in ideas about identity, right? It's an ideology that puts at the very center of our politics, at the very center of how we think about the world, which particular group you are born into, what your ascriptive characteristics are. And as I argue in the book, these ideas are a synthesis of different intellectual influences, including postmodernism, postcolonialism, and critical race theory. So I call it the identity synthesis because it synthesizes these intellectual influences and because it really puts sort of our group belonging at the center of how we should perceive the world, how we should treat each other, even of how the state should treat all of us.
Now, is this the same? I mean, what do you think about the word woke? Because that's the elephant in the room here, isn't it? Well, how does it relate to it? What do you feel about that word?
I think it is roughly the same as what we denote when we use the word woke. I sort of had a little bit of hesitation calling it, the case against woke or something like that, because, first of all, you sort of sound a little bit like an old man shouting at the clouds when you go on about woke this and woke that. And certainly because I really wanted to dissect this ideology in a serious way, I am critical of it. It is a critical book, but I also want to uncover its history and present its nature in a fair way. And I think for that and for our whole public conversation around this topic, it would be really useful to have a more neutral term, right? Yeah. I mean, think about something like socialism, right? But some people in the audience who might think of themselves as socialists, there might be some or many people in the audience who really don't like socialism, But we can all agree to call that ideology socialism however we feel about it. I think we need something similar for this new set of ideas. And woke has now become so polemical that it's not going to serve. So I'm suggesting that antisynthesis, but I you know, I don't care what people call it, as long as we can actually have a serious conversation about it.
Yeah, I mean, the term that I've started to, I mean, I shied away from using the word woke as well, partly because it's insulting to people, also because some people embrace it as a badge of honor, as we saw with the Church of England doing that just a couple of weeks ago here, saying it's okay to be woke, that Jesus would be woke. And also because it feels a bit too flippant, and it feels like you're being needlessly provocative when actually it's a serious matter, it's a serious threat. And I mean, the term that I have tended to use is the new radicalism, because it encompasses identity politics, as it were, but also their Islamist allies. And what the common denominator is this radicalism that's spread across this wide spectrum of different intellectual traditions and people, but they're united by this radical attempt to overturn society in the favor of some sort of utopian vision.
Yeah, I like that term as well. I think there's, you know, I like the new radicalism. I hadn't heard that before, but I think that makes sense. You know, some people talk about things like the successor ideology, because it really is trying to supplant and succeed liberalism, and is really conceived as a frontal attack on liberalism. So there's sort of different attempts to name it. Again, I'm sort of less, I care less about which particular name we're going to use than that hopefully at some point we will have an agreed upon term that actually allows us to formulate that there is something genuinely new here, that it's in you know, crying out for a serious investigation, and that I believe there's been good reasons to worry about the fact that this ideology is going to turn out to be deeply counterproductive. And at least for the purposes of my book, my public appearances, I wanted to have a term that I can use. And so that's what how I settled on the identity synthesis. But again, if people want to prefer to talk about woke, because that just seems more straightforward, that's fine. I think the new radicalism is a good term as well. I'm sort of relatively agnostic about what exact term we should use.
So tell me about the identity trap.
So, you know, this is the ideology, right? Well, I argue that the ideology is a trap. What I like about the metaphor of a trap is that it contains multiple elements. But first of all, there's a lure, right? There's something that draws people in when we fall into a trap. Something that smart and well-intentioned and rational people are going to be attracted to. And I think there's an element of that with this ideology, right? It claims to be the most radical, consistent, uncompromising way to fight against injustices, forms of discrimination, inequalities, but that's certainly real, right? I mean, our societies have written good ideals onto the flags for a long time, but in their reality, they have been anti-Semitic, racist, sexist, discriminatory in all kinds of ways. And so that is what draws people into this ideology. The problem is that the ideology turns out to be counterproductive, turns out to be a trap. And it does so on a number of levels. It does so politically, because rather than setting up universal values and neutral rules that diffuse social conflict, but make it easier for us to cooperate with each other, what it actually does is to encourage a form of zero-sum conflict in which we always have to speak in the name of our group, in which what we get from the state or forms of recognition we get in society are dependent on whether or not our group is currently favored or disfavored. And so therefore you always are in this immediate form of group rivalry with others. It's also, I think, a personal trap. You know, I think that a lot of my students have been encouraged all of their lives to define themselves by the particular intersection of identities at which they happen to fall. And, you know, while obviously where we come from is important to most people, and probably to most people on this call, this being, you know, a Jewish-themed event, right? And it's perfectly healthy and fine to have that sense of pride in where you come from and what your cultural origin is, or what your religion might be. You know, you also have to recognize that it doesn't define you wholly, right? My brother stands at a similar intersection of identities than I do, but I'm very different from him. And if my standing in the world is going to be identical to that of my brother, if people perceive us as exactly the same because we stand at very similar intersection of identities, you know, I wouldn't feel seen as an individual. I don't think an ideology that encourages people to think of themselves like that, and many schools in America now explicitly encourage people to think of themselves as racial beings, to define themselves by their racial identity in that kind of way. I don't actually think that that helps people develop a healthy sense of self and to gain the kind of social recognition that they rightly and understandably seek.
Now, it seems to me that you're quite generous towards people who fall into the identity trap. You allow them a good motivation deep down, and you acknowledge the inequalities that they're seeking to address, even though you question the ways in which they're seeking to address it. I mean, personally, I feel rather less generous than you. I feel more scathing. I feel more threatened, I guess. And the reason is that I feel that it's not so much what they believe, it's the fact that the ideology comes with an instinct to try to impose it on everybody else and to create a new set of taboos so that if you don't agree with them, you are bad, you're cancelled, you're a phobe of some sort, even though most people don't agree with them. Most people are phobes, and it's a conquering mentality. It feels to me shades of fascism to it. Or intolerance. And so I read your book feeling I admire your generosity, but I couldn't quite bring myself to share it. I'm a bit more angry about it.
Well, I'm angry about the ideology, in particular many applications of it as well, that have really proven quite disastrous. I mean, to give one example from the United States, you know, virtually every country in the world rolled out scarce vaccines for COVID on the basis of age, because we know that elderly people were just much more likely to die from COVID than younger people. That was the case in the United Kingdom, I believe. But in the United States, the key committee advising the Centers for Disease Control determined that even further would be the most practical course of action and it would likely save most lives. It was unethical because older Americans happen to be disproportionately white. And so therefore they prioritized a much larger group of essential workers, which ended up including, you know, movie producers in LA and finance executives in New York and college professors in the state of Maryland, like myself, even though I was teaching on Zoom. So that I think was really disastrous. And by the way, I think it ultimately killed more non-white people as well as white people, because if you give a vaccine to two 25-year-old black Uber drivers rather than one 80-year-old black retiree, more black people are going to die statistically speaking. So I'm certainly angry about those applications. When it comes to the people who hold these ideas, I see a range, right? I see some people who have bought into a false ideology, but have certainly the character flaw of becoming fanatics and fighting for these ideas in a fanatical way that certainly betrays a character flaw. I have many students now who sort of, the starting assumption is that these ideas are right, because that's what we've been taught all their lives. Because actually these ideas now are so influential in the educational system, especially in the United States, that's what they've been taught from first grade. And they're decent, thoughtful people who simply haven't yet woken up to borrow a phrase from the ideological slumber, who may change their mind as they age and mature. I mean, there's certainly some people who use that ideology as a cover to bully and to exclude. Right, there's certainly, and we know this from psychological studies, both on the far right, but also on the far left, people who are characterized by dark personality triad, by Machiavellianism and narcissism and the urge to dominate, and who are drawn to ideology that give them reason to say anybody who doesn't believe these ideas is a terrible human being, and we can do what we want to them. And certainly some of the converts to this ideology are motivated, consciously or not, by those kinds of character traits as well. So I think there's a big range. But to take an ideology seriously, I think you have to examine and refute the most attractive version of it rather than the least attractive version of it.
Right. But it's the least attractive version that's the biggest threat. And, you know, one thing that's happened since your book came out was the atrocities of October the 7th, which had this great radicalizing, polarizing effect, particularly on university campuses. And, you know, in my book, Israelophobia, I teased out some of the cultural streams that had led to this new form of anti-Semitism, which is the same as the old form, only directed at the Jewish state rather than the Jewish race or the Jewish religion. And once a couple of strong streams of the, one is Soviet propaganda that's come into the left, anti-Zionist propaganda, and the other is American identity politics, which is what you're talking about. And they've led to this really, really terrifying instinct. We've all seen the videos of campus in America involving, you know, Jewish students being abused and barracked and threatened, having to barricade themselves in rooms. You know, we all saw that awful display of those three principals of American universities unable to condemn genocide of Jews without reaching for the context. How has the current state of affairs post October the 7th affected how you think about these ideas? And how can your ideas help us disentangle what's going on?
Yeah, I think this moment hasn't changed how I think about these ideas, but I think these ideas can help to explain how this moment came about. You know, broadly speaking, I think there's sort of four ideas that really come from the intellectual tradition that I dissect in the Identity Trap, which were then applied wholesale to the Middle East conflict in a deeply disturbing way. The first is this idea, this very Manichaean idea, that you can split the whole world into whites and people of color, right? That the natural way to perceive the world is to look at who's white and to look at who's not white, and to impute a naturally suspect status to anybody who's white and a naturally virtuous status to anybody who's not white. And so when you look at the situation in the Middle East and you claim, and obviously I'll get to why all of this is dubious, the Jews are white and Palestinians are non-white, and therefore we must be on the side of Jews, right? On the side of the Palestinians. The second claim is that you can split the whole world into colonizers and the colonized. And here it is assumed that those two categories will empirically overlap. The case in which they don't isn't really considered in the conceptual framework, which is why, of course, Ukraine is not seen as a victim of the Russian colonizer, because the victims are white, so this can't really be a question of colonialism. But it is applied, of course, to the Middle East, and Israel is portrayed as the colonizer in a straightforward way, and Palestinians as the colonized. Third, there's the idea that I discuss also in the book of systemic racism. So the idea here is that, you know, our traditional notion of racism was individual. You know, you're a racist if you hold deprecating views about some other ethnic, cultural, religious group, right? You think people of this group, they are X, you know, they're inferior, they're more stupid, they're ill-intentioned, right? When you're a racist, right? Rightly, people recognize that there's some situations in which people might suffer from discrimination without that form of explicit bias. So the classic example of this, a little outdated now, was, you know, an African-American man trying to hail a cab in the streets of New York. And cab drivers might not pick him up because they think he's more likely to go to a poor neighborhood and it'll be harder for me to pick up the next fare. Perhaps most of the cab drivers who don't stop are Black, right? They're not racist necessarily. They don't necessarily have negative views about Black people. But this would-be passenger is a victim of systemic racism. So far, so good. That's a helpful addition to our vocabulary. But the problem becomes that a lot of woke people, a lot of adherents to the identity synthesis have claimed that the only true nature of racism is systemic, right? So you can only be racist towards somebody if you are part of a dominant group and they are part of a non-dominant group. And since Jews are now portrayed as being part of a dominant group rather than a dominated group, well, there's no way of being anti-Semitic or racist. You know, any kind of action against them must be justified at some level. And then the fourth idea is the idea of intersectionality, that because all different forms of oppression are interrelated, because we have intersection different identities, so I might be oppressed not just as a woman, but also as a Black person or also as a Muslim. You know, anybody who wants to be in good stead and fighting against one ideology has to fight against all the others as well. So if you're Greta Thunberg and you want to be a good environmentalist, you also need to become a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause. And that really led us to these absurd oversimplifications, because of course, you know, plurality of Jews in Israel today are Mizrahi. It's really unclear that they are in some obvious way white. If Palestinians are non-white, their skin colors are quite similar, because obviously a lot of the Jews in Israel weren't just expelled from countries in Europe and fled to Israel, but were in fact expelled from various countries across the Middle East and had nowhere else to go over the course of the last 75 years and ended up in Israel that way. So to call them colonizers in this blanket way is absurd. But of course, we know that it is possible to be racist towards Jews and to be anti-Semitic towards Jews. Jews, in fact, suffer from hate crimes at some of the highest rates in both Britain and the United States. And so the idea that somehow, because racism is structural and Jews are privileged, there's no way of treating Jews unfairly is absurd. And fourth, the idea of intersectionality is how you come up with these kind of strange slogans like, you know, Queers for Palestine and so on, where we saw so strongly, especially in the immediate aftermath of October 7th.
Right. I mean, the idea of, you know, you can't be racist against Jews because it doesn't fit the theory is a very revealing element to it, because it shows that it's putting the ideology before reality. Because if you just look at reality, you can see that Jews have been discriminated against and abused and killed and tortured and murdered for thousands of years. So you would have thought that the test of a good theory is whether it can accurately describe and predict reality. And this doesn't come into that category. So it's people are blinding themselves to an ideology which is a fantasy land and living within that. And as a result, we have the consequences that we see today. But let's, before we go on to what we can do about this, just can you take us through quite briefly, because we don't have that long, and this is a big subject, a whistle-stop tour of the intellectual development of this identity synthesis, as you call it, starting with, you know, Foucault and up through the academy and how it spills out of the academy into contemporary society.
Yeah, and it's really a fascinating story because in part the people who inspire this ideology come to regret it in certain ways. So it's a really interesting story. I do think it starts not with Marx or Gramsci, as some people have claimed, but with a postmodernist, with Michel Foucault in particular. You know, Foucault is very skeptical about the idea of universal truth, about any kind of form of universal value. And he's also, interestingly, skeptical about identity categories. Even though he himself is what we might call a gay man or homosexual, a man who has sex with men, he doesn't identify by that label because he thinks it overly constricts the sort of variety of sexual experiences that people have. One of his most important insights is about the way that political power is exercised. He thinks that it's not just, you know, top down from, you know, the state passing laws and applying them through a bureaucracy and so on. But it's, you know, our conversation is somehow an exercise of political power through the discourse we're constructing as we're speaking to each other. And so Foucault doesn't really believe in progress. He thinks that any one discourse is going to be nearly as constraining, restricting as the next. These sets of ideas, sort of in postmodern tradition more broadly, come to be very influential within the academy. And one of the sets of people who are attracted to them are post-colonial thinkers who are trying to figure out, you know, how to rule their, in many cases, newly independent countries, you know, in the aftermath of colonialism. And so the kind of solvent quality of Foucault is very attractive to them, right? It's a way of sort of pushing back against the kind of Western ideologies that they feel have dominated their countries for a long time. But they start on the process of repoliticizing Foucault. And the first step towards that is to say, well, look, the point is not just to critique these kind of discourses. It's to fight against and invert unjust discourses, right? If the West was able to colonize other parts of the world because of its assumptions about the Orient, about the East, we want to actually change that or turn those assumptions around. That sort of inspires a form of like politicized discourse analysis that becomes really influential in the present day. It's the reason why, you know, today in feminist circles, you know, sort of criticizing or celebrating or engaging with a Barbie movie can be seen as a kind of form of political activism on top of sort of most traditional activism, like, you know, fighting for certain laws around contraception or abortion, something like that. The second step here comes from the Indian literary theorist Gayatri Spivak, who grows up in Kolkata and who's quite horrified when Foucault and Deleuze in an exchange say, you know, Marxists have always wanted to speak for the proletariat, speak on behalf of these groups, you know, these groups, you know, that's too essentializing. It's simplifying these groups too much. We shouldn't try to speak for these groups. People should speak for themselves. And Spivak says, look, that might be possible for a white worker in Paris who has certain basic resources and education, some amount of money, certain democratic rights. It's not possible for what she calls a sort of subaltern, some of the most oppressed people in what at the time she would have called the third world. Somebody has to speak for them. But in order to speak for them, we have to engage in what she calls strategic essentialism. For strategic purposes, we have to accept these kind of essentialist notions of what defines these groups. And that, again, came to be very influential when I look at American schools now, many of which have teachers in the third grade, in the second grade, in the first grade, come into classrooms and split kids up into different groups by race, saying that Black kids are going to go in one classroom and Asian American kids in a second classroom and Latino kids in a third classroom and white kids in a fourth classroom. And we're going to encourage them to think of themselves, to define themselves as racial beings. You know, the hope here is an exercise.
May I just pause you there? Because I think that idea to British people is so extraordinary that kids could be segregated in class, in school, according to race. Does that really happen in America, and how widespread is that?
It happens. It's pretty widespread. There are some legal limits on public schools in the American sense doing that. So state schools tend to do it less, for they have certain sort of seemingly optional events that often are effectively mandatory where that does happen. But nearly all of the elite private schools in the United States have now adopted some of these kinds of trainings. It's not for the whole school day or the school year, to be clear, but they are regular so-called affinity groups, which are often mandatory or sometimes quasi-mandatory, in which kids do get split up in that way. And I think about 50% of American universities now have orientation events that are race segregated, most of which are optional, but often, again, there's a lot of pressure to attend. So this is not a marginal phenomenon. It's not one crazy teacher, you know, who did it somewhere. It's in particular a lot of the schools that that educate the future American elite. But this idea of why it's beneficial comes out of Spivak, right? This idea that, you know, for them to fight against injustice, they have to take on this racial identity because that's what's going to allow them to become sort of great fighters against injustice. Now, by the way, one of my concerns is what's going to happen to the white kids, not because they might be uncomfortable or not because Jews are going to just be flattened into being white in a way that I certainly would personally refuse to accept. But because I think it's going to backfire. Everything we know from history and from social science is that once you tell people, you know, this is your group, that is how you should define, we tend to prefer members of a group to outsiders, often to be very courageous in defending our group, but often capable of great cruelty in how we treat other groups. And so, you know, this is meant to produce a bunch of sort of proud anti-racists. I fear that it's going to produce a bunch of racists.
Has produced, frankly.
And this connects to the sort of political scene. You know, we don't want to talk too much about the American election, A, because there's not an American audience, and B, because even so, I'm sure you're all sick of thinking about Donald Trump. But, you know, there is about 10% of the electorate, of a Republican electorate, that is quite progressive on social issues, that is pretty young, that is disproportionately non-white, and that's going to vote for Donald Trump because of how much they hate the influence of woke ideas in American institutions. And so I do think it is producing that backlash.
So before we talk about what we can do about it, which we should definitely address in about 3 minutes, can you just briefly outline how these ideas, which you're describing are quite esoteric intellectual ideas, particularly in the postmodernist world in France, it was so dense, it was almost incomprehensible to anybody who wasn't of that small intellectual circle. How did these ideas grip the campus, grip the university, grip the academy, and then spread out so ubiquitously almost into society, at least in the elite levels of society?
If you don't mind, let me do one more quick step on the intellectual history and then answer the question. Because the third important movement is critical race theory. And very briefly, you know, critical race theory is really in its origins an attack on the civil rights movement. You know, Derrick Bell, the very interesting sort of founder of critical race theory, who did great work helping to desegregate schools in the 1960s and so on, comes to think of much of that work in many ways as a mistake, and embraces the idea that in some ways schools perhaps should have been separate but truly equal, that rather than integrating schools, we should have had better equipped black schools. And he claims that America has not made any progress on race, that America in the year 2000 is effectively as racist as it was in 1950 or 1850, and that therefore the only way to make progress is to make how we treat people explicitly depend on the kind of group of which they are a part, giving special treatment to groups that have historically been discriminated against. And so you take those five ideas together and you get a lot of the main themes of the identity synthesis, right? The skepticism about universal truths from Foucault, the politicized idea of discourse analysis from Said, the sort of form of strategic essentialism from Spivak, the sort of skepticism that we can make any real historical progress from Bell, and then finally this insistence that how we treat you, how we treat each other in conversation, how the state treats all of us in all kinds of contexts should depend on the group of which we're a part. So how then does this idea go from being marginal to being really influential? You know, when I arrived in the United States for my PhD, I encountered these ideas every now and again in the seminar room or in some academic publication. I thought it's kind of peculiar, but, you know, like most ideas, this is, you know, in the academy, it's not going to have a huge influence on the wider world. And then suddenly, over the course of one decade, roughly the 2010s, it came to have all of that influence and power. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. The first is what I'm calling the short march for the institutions, right? That these ideas come to predominate in a lot of the elite institutions, especially in Ivy League universities, increasingly in the, you know, Russell Group universities in Britain and so on. And so some of the most influential people who go out into media companies and NGOs and corporations and politics and law are trained and schooled in these ideas. And so they become particularly influential institutions that are sort of very receptive to the views and the preferences of a younger staff. The second element here is social media and the way in which a new set of social media platforms, starting with now obscure platforms like Tumblr, encourage people to redefine themselves by their identity and make it much easier to have experimentation with identities, to invent new identities, right? I mean, when you and I were at school and it was still mostly an offline world, the identities you had available to you, you know, had to have some real life people who already shared something like that, right? In a school that made the numbers sort of limited. And so you had an option of 8 or 10 different identities. On Tumblr, you could find 10 people somewhere in the world who shared this new identity that you were inventing. Suddenly, the option for how to think of yourself was much, much broader. And then the sort of way in which these different ideas were held together became a sort of popularized version of the identity synthesis, and many ways a vulgarized version. And I sort of was really struck by its new influence when I came across a website called everydayfeminism.com in about 2015 that had articles like, you know, 5 things to tell your yoga teacher who thinks cultural appropriation is fun. And they had these sort of BuzzFeed style listicle articles that were really channeling what was originally quite abstruse academic theory in that kind of viral content that we now all know from social media. And that, I think, was hugely influential in then allowing, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Guardian and other publications to pick up on these ideas and really bring them to a wider audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the most important part, which everybody's waiting for, what can we do about this?
Well, the first thing to do is to retain our belief in rational argument. You can't always convince the most fanatical believers in this ideology, but there's a lot of people who are on the fence, who haven't made up their mind, who haven't thought about these things that hard, who say, well, I do want to fight against injustice in the most radical possible way, but I'm a little, you know, the people who celebrated the Hamas terror attack after October 7th give me a little bit of pause. I don't quite know how to think about all of this. And I think that for that, an explanation of his ideology and an account of how to fight back against it, how to argue back against it, is very, very important. I personally am a philosophical liberal, which is to say that, you know, I think there are limits on what the state should be able to do to its citizens. And we should respect basic values like free speech and due process in order to empower people to lead autonomous and self-determined lives in which they're not always subject to the arbitrary will of the state or the electoral majority. And so I think that we should argue against the attack on those kinds of values, try to explain why Frederick Douglass, for example, one of the great African-American political activists in the history of the United States, was a deep believer in free speech, because he pointed out that it is the dread of tyrants. It is the one thing that genuinely vulnerable minorities can use to speak truth to power. And so restrictions on free speech are very, very dangerous. I think there's also kind of humanistic strain that is important to defend. The fact that how we feel about you, how we think about you should not depend on the kind of group into which you are born, but we should be capable, including at the moment in the Middle East, to have empathy for all civilian victims, certainly for the victims who were brutally murdered by Hamas on October 7th, but of course also for the children who are dying in bombardments on the Palestinian side today, that we're capable of recognizing our shared humanity, even in moments of terrible conflict. That is made impossible by an ideology that simply says, well, which group are you a part of? And so therefore, are you one of the virtuous or one of the others? And if you're one of the dominant, then you know we're allowed to do whatever we want to you. That really makes that basic humanism impossible. But then I also think that there's all kinds of different political and religious traditions that I don't necessarily share myself that have big reserves of skepticism towards these ideas as well. Christians as well as Jews talk about how we are made in the image of our creator, and therefore there's a way in which we are connected to each other, and that fact of being human is more important than the particular group you're born into. Buddhists and other religious traditions have similar kinds of values. And by the way, I think small C conservatives in the Burkean tradition or Marxists in a very different tradition all have reason to be skeptical about the claims of the identity synthesis as well. So I think we need an overlapping consensus of people who push back against it.
Right. I mean, I've done many events since October the 7th in the community where people ask, what can we do about this rise in anti-Semitism and Israelophobia, and whether allied to the identity synthesis or separately? And one of the catchphrases that I've tended to repeat is that they have an advantage and we have an advantage. Their advantage is in the numbers, but we have an advantage in that we happen to be right. And you're saying a similar sort of thing, I think. But my question really at this point is that when will the bad idea begin to lose momentum? Because this is a bad idea, a bad ideology that is clearly untrue and a load of rubbish, doesn't produce happiness for anybody, produces social divisions, has no basis in reality, is clearly false. And yet it doesn't seem to be losing momentum. How can we as a society begin to arrest that without losing our liberalism? And what role does government play in that?
Yeah, so, I think one of the striking things about how quickly this ideology won is that there's very little space to understand and argue back against it. And this is particularly bad in the United States because of Trump, because I think when Trump sort of became president, in a lot of left-leaning and mainstream spaces, there's this idea that if you criticize any bad idea on the left, you're secretly running interference for Trump, you're secretly helping Trump, and so therefore we must not do that. And there's a lot of self-censorship. Now, we do live in a free society still, and we are able to speak up. And when an ideology becomes as dominant as the identity synthesis has very quickly, the dams eventually break and people start to feel empowered to say their piece. And I think we've just reached that point. So there is more pushback now. I don't think that means that's the beginning of the end. I think that's naive. I don't think that means that sort of the backlash is here and this ideology is over. That vastly underestimates how much institutional power it's been able to take on very quickly. But I do think that this is the moment in which the weaknesses of the ideology are going to start to be exposed, because for the first time, we are actually able to argue it out properly. And that will help a lot of people to recognize that for their own political, moral, ideological, religious reasons, most of them have reason to be very skeptical of these ideas. So for me, this is going to be a 2025 year fight. I mean, in the same way in which we did have a fight in a very different way between a more moderate liberalism and Marxism for much of the second half of the 20th century, I think this contestation over the identity trap is going to dominate a lot of our academic departments and public discourse and so on over the coming months. Oh, sorry, over the coming decades.
But I mean, part of one of the differences between the opposition between moderate liberalism and Marxism is that Marxism didn't have TikTok. And, these days, it's the sort of cool, rational, moral, humane part of the population who's trying to make arguments and see the best in their motivation and trying to persuade. And then you've got those guys on TikTok loving bin Laden. I mean, I'm not going to say, what do we do about TikTok? But what do we do about TikTok?
Well, so I'm very skeptical about censoring it, right? I've been struck by the way in which many people on the left had debates about censorship regimes in the context of spaces they dominated, right? Progressive college campuses and say, what if we introduce speech codes to stop people from saying terrible, scary, bigoted things, which often weren't all that scary or bigoted, sometimes were. And they said, well, look, obviously here we're always going to hold the power. What's the harm? And this is, I think, the reason why the left went from the free speech movement of the 1960s to the glorification of restrictions on free speech in the last years, because it moved into power, right? It no longer saw itself as oppositional, even if it claimed to be oppositional. It came to see itself, in many ways rightly, as dominant. But of course, the left is now complaining, sometimes for good reason, that it is now on the receiving end of various forms of censorship when it comes, for example, to the Middle East. And so I just think that, Jews in particular have two different ways to respond to this moment, right? One is to see that every minority group on Harvard's campus has some special protected status. And if you criticize them in ways that might be offensive, you're quite unceremoniously going to be kicked out of college in many cases. And then to say, well, how is it right that every other group enjoys this, but we don't? We want the same kinds of protections, right? But that, I think, is naive about how power is going to work on those spaces. We don't want to make our well-being and our equal treatment depend on whether we happen to have the president's ear at any one time, right? The other alternative is to say, let's stop the game, right? Let's actually enforce academic freedom. What was so galling about the testimony of Claudine Gay in front of Congress was not just that she was saying we have to tolerate a lot of unpleasant speech on campus as part of academic freedom, it's that Harvard had completely failed to live up to those standards of academic freedom for the last decade. So I think that we should live up to genuine free speech, and that means the government should not be allowed to censor TikTok, that we should not trust people in Whitehall or in the White House to make decisions for us about what we can say and what we can see, because that otherwise makes us subject to these shifting power dynamics about who happens to be influential at any one time.
Right. So we're going to move to questions here, Yasha. We've got quite a few, so let's try to get through as many as we can. One interesting one here. In a recent interview to France Inter, you said you considered France more immune to the ideology of the identity synthesis because of the core French republican values shaping its political system. Do you think that other European nations might be as immune, or is it a French speciality? How about Germany? And also, are you blaming British wokeness on the monarchy?
I'll think about that second question.
That was my
on the first question, I think probably it is a French specificity. Other European countries may have other specific reasons to have some amount of resistance to wokeness. But I think the French elite is in some ways unique in having a very strong sense of mission and a very strong sense of its own values. Now, many of these values I share. I think broadly speaking, French Republican values and the idea of laïcité is very appealing. I think in certain cases, it can be overly rigid. It can be applied in a way that is hostile to religion in general, rather than just to the intermingling of church and state. But I think that it is helping for now to give some French institutional decision makers the courage to not travel the easiest path, to not give in to any demands by activists, because they actually have a sense of what they stand for. I think in the United States, we have a crying lack of that. One of the reasons why so many institutions have been colonized so quickly is that people always take the path of least resistance, the thing that most protects their career or their institution. If that means giving in to the demands of activists, then people are willing to do that. But there's sort of nothing on the other side of a ledger. It's interesting. In Britain, I think there also isn't a strong ideology. One of the charming things about Britain is that it's a less ideological country than France, of course. But there is a little bit of a sense of sort of British decency or fair play that is, I think, often offended by certain elements of the woke movement. And that perhaps is sort of Britain's form of resistance. Whether or not that is ultimately stronger or weaker than the French ideology is actually a fascinating social scientific question, right? Which of those two things are a better defense? I mean, some countries like Italy are quite immune to it, in part because they're just places where the left doesn't have as much influence, in part because I think it has a different religious heritage. I do think that there's a kind of Protestant religious sort of moral imaginary that is more easily seduced by a form of wokeness than the Catholic view of the world. I would say that different countries are subject to it to different extents. But certainly any country that is Protestant rather than Catholic in historical influence, even if today most people may not be religious, and any country that is closely tied up with the cultural influence of the United States rather than more distantly related to it, is going to feel the force of its ideology. And that's one of the reasons why Britain, of course, has felt it much more strongly than France or Italy.
Exactly. I mean, I think the one thing I was going to add to that is the English language. The fact this is really an American thing and we speak the same language and we're so influenced by America, as Tomiwa Owolade put in his book, This Is Not America, described that very clearly. We import so much of their culture here, and this seems to have come in as a kind of virus. Another question. Jewish advocacy organizations like the ADL are being criticized by the modern critiques of woke ideology for their employment of identity politics tactics. Do you think the Jewish community should be more internally critical of our own use of identity politics?
Yes, depending on what exactly we mean by identity politics, right? So one of the reasons why I avoid the term identity politics is that I think there's good forms of it and there's bad forms of it. I lay out in the book one good form of it, which is a lot of the mainstream African-American political tradition. I mentioned Frederick Douglass earlier. He didn't just defend free speech. He said in his wonderful speech, What to the Negro is the 4th of July, you assembled here to celebrate these ideas of the Declaration of Independence, the idea that all men are born equal. I mean, at the same time, there's still slaves in this country. You're hypocrites. But he didn't say, because you're hypocrites, we should rip up these values. He said, if you mean these values seriously, you have to live up to them, right? You have to free the slaves, but you have to actually apply those universal values in a way that applies to everybody. That, I think, is a virtuous form of identity politics, a form of identity politics that can rally victims of particular injustices or simply members of a particular community, but in defending their inclusion under universal rules, in order to make sure that they don't suffer discrimination and that they are treated as equals in their society. That is what I think Martin Luther King did. It's, by the way, what made the gay rights movement so phenomenally successful in the 90s and the 2000s, and what makes elements of a trans movement much more divisive today, because it has veered away from that stance. And so I would say, as long as Jews engage in identity politics in that tradition, but they often have, but that people like Frederick Douglass for a different group have also done, which is to say, we want to ensure that we fight against forms of discrimination and prejudice, and that we insist on our equal treatment in society, on our equal rights, I don't think that that is a problem. I do think that there's this trap at the moment, which I mentioned earlier, very understandably, that in an environment in which the only thing that has currency is claims to victimhood, and which the only way you can advance sort of better treatment of yourself is by claiming new group specific rights, you know, we're going to say, you know, on this campus, you're not allowed to say anything that might be perceived as a microaggression against African Americans or against trans people. Well, by what logic are you excluding us from the same forms of protected status? We want to have the same things. And so we're going to advocate for this professor to get fired and for that student to get fired. I don't think that's the right approach. I think we need to defend the universal values, which have always allowed Jews to flourish the most in countries like Britain and the United States when they were actually applied.
Right. And in fact, in the same area, we had a question here. I've only got probably time for maybe two more questions. So this is one. It's about the limitations of free speech. And the questioner asks, isn't one of the problems with free speech that some know how to exploit it? And they gave the example of David Miller. I'm not sure if you're familiar with David Miller and his claim that he claimed that his form of anti-Zionism was a protected characteristic. And he was awarded that argument in the tribunal. And liberals tend to be reticent to shut down protests. So it seems to me this is a sort of Karl Popper type of argument. You know, Popper wrote, if we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we're not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. What do you feel? What's your position on the limitations of free speech?
Yeah, so let me start by talking to this sort of Popper paradox. I think that that's often misapplied in very dangerous ways because it can be a license to shut down anything you don't like, right? And by that logic, there's going to be people who say that anyone who defends Israel is an advocate of genocide and somebody who's intolerant and therefore needs to be shut down, right? I mean, you open the way for these competing claims of who the intolerant person is who needs to be shut down. And who knows who's going to win that? I mean, you know, quite recently, it looked like there might be a realistic prospect of Jeremy Corbyn being prime minister of the United Kingdom. And he certainly would have had one kind of interpretation of this. Sorry.
But isn't it the case? It's not what somebody is saying. It's the intolerance that is intolerable. As in, if somebody is arguing that, you know, Israel is a genocidal state, or the opposite, that's one thing. But if they're saying Israel is a genocidal state, and if you oppose me, I'm going to shut you down, that's the intolerance that we have to guard against.
Well, but this is exactly why I think it is not about the content of speech, it is about the form of behavior. The thing that allowed Harvard and MIT and those places to get out of hand, that those universities were unwilling to apply the basic rules of free speech to many of those pro-Palestinian protesters. Right, that there were people who disrupted class, who occupied common spaces, who intimidated particular students. None of that is allowed according to the basic rules of free speech. Right, nobody has the right to go and stop an event from taking place. We've always understood that that's the hackler's veto. We can't allow that, or no free speech is going to be possible. Right, but to speak back to the Popperian paradox, you know. If somebody says, I hate democracy and I think we should all be living under an absolute monarchy, I have a good right to say this, even if it's foolish. If they say, I think democracy is terrible and we should live under an absolute monarchy or under a theocracy, and I'm going to go and get my bomb and blow people who don't agree with me up, well, of course, that person we cannot tolerate, right? That person we have to draw the line towards. But I don't think, so yes, Popper is right, that we need to take concrete actions against people who are actually unwilling to live under a tolerant scheme of social cooperation. But that doesn't mean we can just shut out anybody if we don't like the content of their views, because otherwise we're trusting the people in power to make the right calls every time. And I don't trust the people in power to make the right calls every time. That's why I think Jews in particular must defend a very far-reaching concept of free speech. But every scheme of free speech has rules, and one of those is you can't physically intimidate people, you can't disrupt events.
Right, so one of the
those rules have to be enforced.
So one of the debates in Britain at the moment is the use of various slogans and concepts on these Palestine marches that are taking place here every Saturday. Things like "From the River to the Sea." I mean, you have the same thing in the States. Palestine will be free. Things like, you know, globalize the intifada, and other more offensive slogans and intimidating slogans. What's your position on those? Do you think that that's fine? They should be allowed to express themselves because they're not imposing it on anybody, or do you think that should be where the boundary of free speech lies, and that's beyond it should be shut down?
I know I may make myself unpopular with this audience. I find these slogans to be disgusting and irresponsible. In my publication, we're running in a few days an interesting article by somebody who's very sympathetic to a Palestinian cause, who says to Palestinian activists, if you actually want to find a hearing, you should abandon these slogans because they make people scared and they're offensive and they're not going to persuade anybody who's not already on your side. So I object to these slogans for deep moral reasons. But yes, I think that they should be legal, because I think a police force that can decide that from the river to the sea is a form of hate speech that can be punished could just as well decide the same thing about forms of political speech that I find to be moral and right.
And what about if somebody was chanting "Kill the Jews"?
There you're going to have different legal regimes in different countries. I certainly think that's something that's incitement to violence.
Morally speaking, do you think in principle?
Well, morally speaking, all of it is. I mean, morally speaking, it's obviously terrible, and morally speaking, other things are terrible. What I mean is, I think in the British context, I'm comfortable with narrow laws about the incitement to violence that would criminalize something like that. In the United States, which has a different tradition of the First Amendment, which would probably cover that, I'm reluctant to give up on the First Amendment because I think that would have bad political consequences. So that's why I'm drawing the distinction here between the British context and the American context.
Sure. Okay. Well, I think we've got time for one more question. I'm sorry to anybody who's put up a question that we haven't got time to get to. But this last one I thought was quite interesting. Is there a sense in which the identity synthesis is defeatist because it gives up on universalist principles?
Yes, I think that's a really good observation. I mean, first of all, it's just a depressing vision of society, right? It's saying, look, we can't really make any progress by living up to our values. And so therefore, we need to abandon those values and make the whole of society into this kind of, competition between different groups, in which what you get is always dependent on the group you're in. Rather than dreaming of a society in which how we treat people is going to become less dependent on the group they're born into, we're resigning ourselves to a society in which this will always play this tremendous role. So I want to defend a more optimistic version of liberalism, which says that our societies have historically been deeply unjust. We've actually been able to make tremendous progress. I think it's undoubted that our society today treats many minority groups much more humanely than it did 100 or 50 or even 25 years ago, and that's something we should be proud of. But that form of universalism is, in the traditional sense, a progressive creed. It always recognizes injustices that remain and fights to remedy them, fights to create a better world. And so it is not a defense of a status quo. It is a set of instructions about how to make the world better than it is. And I think we're much more likely to continue to make this progress by recognizing that these values have inspired tremendous improvements in the past and continue to inspire genuine improvements. That, I think, is actually the ambitious vision of a kind of society that we might be able to share one day. Whereas I agree with you, the identity trap is a defeatist vision of a society that I wouldn't want to live in. I think most people wouldn't ultimately want to live in.
Well, thank you, Ashton. Inspiring note on which to finish. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to the audience for being here. Just a reminder, you can, of course, buy Ashton's book using the link on the webinar chat. You'd be able to buy my book too, but I'm sure you've got it already, so that's fine. And more events that are coming up, you can find online and in person by visiting jewishliteraryfoundation.co.uk. So happy rest of book week. I will see you next week, a couple of events on Sunday. And Yasha, thank you for joining us all the way from the States, and good luck with the fight against the identity synthesis.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Israel War Briefing from the Jewish Chronicle with me, Jake Wallace-Simons. Join us next time for more insight and analysis from leading experts.